guys, how you doing? It's Coach Treggs here, the founder of 30 Plus Men's Fitness, and I hope you're all doing good. We're keeping it moving again this week with another fantastic guest, a guy that I actually spoke to earlier on in the year, but silly bollocks, that's me, forgot to record it. But thankfully, being the gent that he is, he kindly offered to come back on. I'm sat with one of my peers virtually, and it's a great honour to have Phil Learney on the podcast today. Phil, thank you so much, and how are you?
You're welcome, Mark. I'm very well, thank you. Thanks for the big props running in.
No.
Very well, thank you, sir.
Brilliant, dude. Now, look, I know we've spoken before, and I know it all flowed lovely, but obviously it was only me and you that got to hear it. So, look, we're going to make it happen for the world this time and all our 30-plus men's fitness followers. So, look, Phil, let's dive into it. For those of my guys that have sort of maybe just started to follow the 30 Plus Men's Fitness podcast and don't have a real eye on the fitness industry, who is Phil Learney?
Who is Phil Learney? I'm an old man in the industry, I guess. I've been in it 20 years. I've been a personal trainer for most of that time. Retired from personal training in October. I kind of came out of retirement 3.5 weeks ago to coach one person in particular. I can't divulge much more.
Right.
But it's
okay.
Kind of a special project.
Yep.
That might come to life, might not.
Yep.
And then over the last few years, went into education, probably about 7 years ago. Started doing seminars, various bits and pieces. Enjoyed doing it, saw the value in it with respect to what I wanted to do in the industry, the impact I wanted to make. And it just expanded from there, really. We launched the Advanced Coaching Academy it's just over 18 months ago now. We're around about 3,000 members.
That's amazing.
It's grown quite well, and that's over about 40 different countries. And that is just an educational platform, pretty much designed predominantly for coaches. We have people who just joining for their own interests, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, my key thing now is education.
Brilliant, dude.
Yeah.
So you said you're a bit of an old man in the industry, but on our previous call, you told me you were only 39 years old.
Yeah. I'm 40 this year.
Yeah, well, I'll be 39 in October, so I don't regard myself as old. So come on, Phil, do yourself a credit, dude. All right, so yeah.
I'm an old man in the industry.
Yeah.
I know what you mean.
So look, you say you've been in it obviously a long time. I know you told me this before, but for our listeners, tell me where it all began. I know you're based in London now, and I know, but I know that that's a northern accent. So let's go right back, and let's go right back to when you're in school. What was it that got you into health and fitness? And tell me the story, sort of fast track story to take you to where you are now.
Well, my interest in this industry started when I was about 13, 14, and that was sort of a self-orientated thing that I did. I was very overweight as a kid, and put up with a fair bit at school, and then the local gym opened near the school, so I started going to the gym when I was about 13, 14. I used to get a friend from the village I grew up in to pick me up and take me home at 5:30, so I finished school at 1:30.
Yeah.
I'd walk to the gym, I'd train, and then he'd pick me up at 5:30 and take me home. So it was, and from that, with respect to education, I was always into sports, did a lot of sports, despite my, my physical character,
sure,
should be said, and was very big into rugby, was big into cricket. There was pretty much anything activity-wise I used to do. But it sort of stemmed from that, my interest in sport, things like this, and then through school, my two interests were I wanted to be a graphic designer originally, and then I did a bit of work placement, didn't enjoy it, and then thought, well, hell, what's the only other thing I'm half decent at that I enjoy? And that was sort of sports. Originally, I wanted to get into sports performance, dealing with athletes, et cetera, but it was just really the way the industry took me, and I ended up dealing with people who were very much like myself back when I was younger, and their intents were the same, really, so I started back in the Lake District, in a town called Penrith. I went to university. I was a fitness instructor prior to that. Went to university, came back, did a degree in sport and exercise science. Got a job back at the place I started. worked as a fitness instructor. Used to do all the one day and sort of stuff, handing out towels, blah blah blah. You know, your standard stuff in the industry.
Yeah.
And I actually proposed them personal training, which they didn't offer at the time. And I said, well, you know, either you let it happen, or I'm probably going to leave. And they said, well, we're worried about you because we're not sure there's demand for it. And I said, I'm prepared to take that risk because either way, I'm either going or I'm staying.
Sure.
And they launched it, and I was full within the first week, and it sort of went from there. And then I helped the company I worked for take across several gyms and across the country as well. And went from there, really. Ended up in Leeds, worked in Leeds for a little bit, worked abroad a little bit, and ended up back in London. So, yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah, so you know, like when you started out in the gym, because I always ask everyone this, because was there any like particular plan you're following? Because I remember sort of my introduction to the gym probably a couple of years later than you, but I remember me and my mate at the time just discovered like weight training, and we would literally ride down there on our bikes. Sometimes he'd give me like a crossie, you know, where you sit on the handlebars. We'd go in there, like literally blast every bloody machine to death, end up with like 1,000 ab crunches. And we thought we were the bollocks. I mean, but we were like, we didn't have a clue about any type of programming. We just do a bit of everything. Did you have a program? Was there somebody that you followed?
No, I mean, it's an interesting story there, I suppose. In all the years of me training in a gym, the first time somebody stopped me in a gym was in around about 2005.
Right.
And nobody ever pulled me up in a gym and told me my technique was wrong or to give me some advice or anything like that. I was basically left to my own devices from when I walked in the gym to when I walked out. I remember having an induction, and that was literally some kid who, you know, couldn't be bothered. She basically said, this chest press is how it works, this is leg press is how this works, blah, 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 et cetera, et cetera. If you want a program, come to reception, we'll write you one out. And that was it. So a lot of my knowledge came from, you know, picking up. Hell, I remember that the first time I bought a bodybuilding magazine, and it was that reluctance as a young kid to walk into WH Smith town and to reach for that kind of almost top shelf magazine that nobody really bought. And I remember buying a copy of Flex. It was weird. It felt bizarre because it was this picture of this semi naked, oiled up, you know, tan to the max, just popping out everywhere. And I think if I remember, it was actually, it was Dorian Yates up front. If I recall.
Yeah.
But I remember picking up this magazine and thinking, right, I'm going to get all the information I need from this. And then I start following these bodybuilding routines. They weren't, because I was a newbie. But they weren't ideal for me. But again, if I knew then what I know now, I wouldn't have done them. But I was copying these hugely high volume isolation stuff.
Yep.
You know, lots of split routines, you know, kind of your bro splits and this, that, the other. So that was what I did. And obviously, because I was new to it, you know, I did develop a bit, and I was always a big kid. I'm fairly thick set. I have a big set of shoulders, and you know, I lost weight. As I lost weight, I developed muscle because I wasn't shy of food. I loved food. I grew up in a pub, you know, and it was. I did what I could, and I remember pounding treadmills for 30 minutes, probably a session. And I used to run, and I used to do cross training, and I used to do everything. So we kind of, I'd do a 10-minute warm-up, then I'd train 40 minutes, and then I'd go back on the treadmill, I'd do another 30, 40 minutes, and it was, you know, I'd do HIIT stuff, I'd do, you know, long-distance stuff,
yep.
do sprints, and it was just literally whatever I could handle when I went in, and then there'd be charts on the walls, and I'd learn some diets, and it was just a real mishmash of everything.
Sure.
And,
sure.
Then in 2005, bizarrely, training in New York, and this gym full of the biggest lumps you've ever seen in this gym was a Gold's Gym, you know, in Central Manhattan, and which is now closed, I think. And this young girl who was training, she's one of the PTs, walks up to me and said to me about my technique or something. And I knew my technique was out slightly because I had some shoulder problems the year before. That's why I remember the year. And she said, look, you need to try and do this, blah, blah, blah. And at the end of it, I was like, I was so shocked that somebody had actually came up, give me advice after all those years of me training. Nobody had ever done it before. And there was this little tiny thing
sure.
came over to me, this girl who must have been so intimidated by all these other coaches and trainers. So I went up to manager after before I left, and I said, look, you need to keep hold of her. So she's a very good coach.
Yeah.
You know, I went over, gave her a props, blah, blah, blah. And that's the only time anybody had ever pulled me up in a gym. Told me to adjust my technique. Only time in 20 years going to the gym.
Wow, that's incredible. Incredible. But so I want to go back to you were saying, like, you were brought up in a pub and you were always sort of chubby as a kid. So, similar sort of thing to me. I wasn't brought up in a pub, but I was definitely chubby as a kid and I really struggled. And, you know, like you said, you love your food. I also love my food. So it really resonates. So did you know how when did you first sort of realize that you might have been carrying a few extra pounds? And did you get any stick for it at school? And was that sort of a massive driver for you to go and change?
Enormous. It was, yeah,
really?
I had hell at school, Mark.
Really?
Because back then it wasn't, you know, obesity wasn't a big thing. And, you know, I was in a group in a little village. You know, I was the only kid there that was really overweight. You know, and, yeah. And, you know, I stood out like a sore thumb. Whereas now, you know, the shape I was, I look back and I go, well, was it actually that big? And really, when you look around nowadays,
sure.
I wasn't, but again, there is far more acceptance now, there's more, and also it's that thing where if you stand out in amongst the crowd, you're that one person, you're that target all the time.
Yeah.
And that was kind of the problem I had when I went to secondary school. I really remember one other kid who really got sick, and he was much bigger than I was. And it was, you know, and it was just relentless, Mark.
Yeah.
You know, and that was my drive. That was
true.
I didn't turn this around. I played sport all the time. Clearly, something's amiss. And what was amiss was basically my dietary intake.
Yeah.
You know, I was eating crap.
Yeah.
Crap's the wrong word. I wasn't eating crap. I was eating a lot of very calorie dense foods.
Yeah.
And you know, my parents were cool with, they didn't want to ever stop me eating food. They knew nothing about food science. They knew nothing about calories. They knew, you know, my dad's. You know, as big as a bunch of dog, and my mum wasn't hugely overweight. And it was just a funny environment. And obviously, I was, you know, my idea of drinking fluid was to go into the bar with a glass and fill it with Coke.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, straight off the pub. But I didn't know any better. And slowly, I taught myself after about the age of 13, 14, when it got, you know, when I went to secondary school, really was the big thing, because then it was another level. It wasn't just a bit of torment here and there. Because remember, in the village, everybody knew each other.
Yeah.
So, if you were getting sick too much, your parents, your mum would go to another mum and sort of say, look, hey, up. And secondary school was a whole different ballpark. So all of a sudden, you're in this big school with all these town kids and blah, blah, blah. And it just moved to the next level. And it was, you know, it was horrendous. And, you know, I remember a lot of it very distinctly. And that was my driver. And that was something where I look back now and I'm like, well, that was really my key driver for a lot of my decisions in
Massive.
Life was proving other people wrong. And to this day, I'm very much, you know, mentally attuned to that. You know, one of the worst things anybody can ever tell me is that I can't do something.
Sure.
Because I'll prove you wrong. And I'll do everything in my ability to do that. You know, and it was just a struggle.
Yeah.
And obviously, I want to chase around. Then I look back now and I learned a lot there. I learned a lot about what it was like to be overweight. I learned a lot about what it felt like to be overweight. I used to have really bad knee problems. You know, I had osteoarthritis sliders when I was a kid.
Sure.
So, you know, I'd wake up some mornings, my kneecap would be like over to the side of my knee.
Yeah.
I had loads of issues. And I remember playing rugby all the time. And, you know, I had neoprene knee supports on from a very early age. And, you know, I used to wear them to warm my knees up. And, you know, there was all sorts there, but yeah, that was the key driver, and I had never ever set foot in a gym unless I needed to do something about that. So really, it was a life change.
Yeah.
In a good way for me, but obviously, I was looking from the perspective that, you know, you look back at stuff like that and think about, well, what if they hadn't opened that gym in town? What if they hadn't opened that gym in town? There was nowhere for me to go and train, and I didn't want to get into that, and I didn't like sport, and I didn't like, you know, and you look at it, you think, well, there could have been a completely different outcome there.
And do you know what, Phil? Kids, they're fucking brutal, aren't they? I look back now and I remember it's awful. Yeah, I mean, like, it really is quite frightening. fucking a lot of the listeners will laugh now, but it is for over 30s men. But, you know, some of the kids were so brutal in my school. I remember, like, we all stripped off for, like, swimming once. And this kid got bullied because he had pubic hair. And I thought, and looking back, you think, fucking hell, he was more advanced than any of us. And we all made him cry because he had fucking pubes. Oh, do you know what I mean?
Honestly, some of the stories I can tell you, you know, there was kids doing wrestling moves on me and shit, hitting me with chairs.
Oh, fucking
hell. And this was like a regular occurrence. You know, Friday afternoons, every Friday afternoon, as far as I can remember, you know, that was what would happen on a Friday afternoon. Now, a religious education class is that I'd walk in, somebody beat me about with a chair or a ruler or
fuck
something.
Fuck you, no.
And you know, that's what it was like. And that was my key driver. Because obviously, at the same time, you also want to, I want to get, you know, get the better of these people because, you know, I want to be stronger. I want to be more physical. I want to be able to stand up for myself. And, you know, and that was part of it. And it was, I don't think it was really, I couldn't really remember whether it was actually a physique thing, whether it was actually I wanted to be stronger and be able to fight, or whether I don't know. And I was never really a big fighter. I'd always try and talk people down.
Sure.
And I've never, you know, as a kid, it was never something that was kind of, you know, I wasn't aggressive. I wasn't, you know, and it was the same with rugby, you know. It was never something I got involved with in rugby, but it was, you know, if I needed to, I would.
Yeah.
You know, and it was how it was.
Mate, I really appreciate you sharing this, because I know we didn't talk about it before, and it's something I would have never have picked up, because quite often you when you speak to people, you can tell if they're sort of carrying, you know, a little bit of baggage from the past, and if they've had that kind of, they've been through that kind of stuff. And I would have never picked up, so I really appreciate the share, mate, because I know that there's a lot of guys probably been through the same thing. They got young kids, they might be going through the same thing, and sometimes that pain is so great that forces you to change, and it resonates a lot with me, because I was sort of very chubby in school as a kid, and I was always last on the sports days. And my story is, I actually, when I went to secondary school, they said, right then, lads, we're doing cross country today. And I thought, oh, fucking hell, what's this? Here we go. And it turned out to be a 3-mile run around, you know, the local hill. And I thought, right, I'm going to come last. And so what happened was, is we all started running. I'm in last place. And then about a minute into it, as we all went out of the gate, every fucker started to slow down. And, you know, I went into fifth, third, and then next thing I know, I'm in fucking first place. And I realise I might be carrying the timber, but I've actually got a good engine. I've got a good heart and lungs. And I come home first, and honestly, Phil, it fucking changed my life, because I was like, I'm good at something here. I'm not last anymore. And I ended up really getting into my cross-country running, 1,500-metre running, 3,000-metre running, became district champion. But that pain initially of, you know, being a fat chubby kid, it was awful.
I don't know where I sit on this really, because I think stuff like that is very much into character building things.
Yes.
But again, is that based on how your character takes it and how you deal with it? You know, because I can see, you know, it's kind of like a sliding door scenario where you go, right, hold on, what if I wasn't that way inclined? What if when somebody told me I couldn't do something, I believe them?
So is it a nature or nurture thing type thing, yeah?
Yeah, this is the thing I say about coaching, and coaching is very, very similar in many respects, that, you know, some people, you can turn around and go, you're not going to be able to do that, and the first thing they'll do is actually fight back. And it's that fight or flight kind of scenario, and it's, you know, for some people that kind of stuff's positive, other people it's negative. Some people don't get the other side of it, unfortunately, and some people do, and some people come out the other side, you know, flying. And I think it is such a, you know, it's the sort of thing I never want anybody to have to deal with, but in the same respect, I think it is part of life, and I think it is part of developing as an individual, and I think it is part of understanding the kind of, you know, the pressure those kind of things can bring to you.
I think it is really interesting, and it happens at all ages, you know. I've got two boys. I know you've got little ones, and you think, God, you'd never want them to go through it. And you know, like even now, my son, who's almost five, came home the other day. We were talking about his friends, and he said, "Oh, so and so called me a meatball head," and I said, "Right." And you know, did that upset you? And he said, "Well." You know, and I think, bloody hell, these kids are brutal. I said, well, if he tells you got a meatball, then it's just because you've got lots of brains, John, all right? So going, but you think it's going on, you know, and it is tough. But look, let's move on a little bit. I mean, what I love is the fact that is the empathy, right, that you have probably been able to share with clients across the years, because you had weight issues yourself and because you got bullied for it yourself. And it's something that I've been through as well. And, you know, to be able to share that empathy, and when you're working with clients, and be able to say to them, look, I've fucking been there. Would you agree that's helped you a lot in your career, Phil?
Hugely. It's like to say a walk a mile in somebody else's shoes. But, you know, when you've been in them shoes, great. But it's also it's the argument where people say, well, you know, you can't train someone unless you played that sport or you can't do whatever. I'm like, that's nonsense, because a lot of it can be taught. You know, I spend a lot of time in the seminars, we talk about, you know, fat loss and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, look, you need to understand what this person's going through from a psychological, physical perspective, you know, behaviours, blah, blah, blah. It's not so easy as just saying to them, look, you need to eat less, you need to exercise more. And it irritates the crap out of me when somebody just comes out and goes, look, you need to do that. I'm like, yeah, clearly. But it's not a matter of the good coach is somebody who tells you that, because that is the most blatantly obvious thing in the world. But a good coach is somebody who can take someone and actually get them to do that.
Yeah.
You know, and that is coaching. That's not, that's, you know, the rest of it is just basically just going, right, I'm gonna keep blurping this statement out about, you know, eat less, move more, eat less, move more, eat less, move more. And I'm gonna tell it to enough people that when one person does it and they succeed, I'm gonna take credit for that.
Mm.
And I'm like, no, that's crap. That's crap. What makes a good coach is somebody who can take 100 people and get results with 98.
Yeah, and they're all individuals as well. Yeah.
Yeah, and the other two, in the time scale you had to work with, them just weren't ready at that point. And that was an intrinsic thing, not an extrinsic thing. So that's something that they have to be ready to change.
Yeah.
Those two people just weren't ready to change, so they're the ones that you have to go, I'm sorry, right now, I can't help you because you're not prepared to do anything for yourself.
This is really interesting stuff. Okay, look, let's get into the coaching side of things. Something we touched on before, and I want to touch on it again now that I've hit record, is how, like, the industry, we've all evolved. I've been in the industry 11 years now, and if I was to listen to myself now, maybe 6 or 7 years ago before the kids come along, I'd be like, whoa, is that Treggs? But I think as we get older, not just with more experience in the industry, but more life experience, our message is able to be adapted. And I've come out a lot recently and said, look, hands up, my view on this has changed. At the time, I only knew what I knew, and I was just trying to do the best for my clients. I got results then, I can get results now, but with an updated perspective on things. So with having said that, tell me a little bit about how you've evolved in the industry, because I know you spoke about some of the articles that you wrote maybe 10 years ago. You wouldn't even recognize them now.
Oh, I can't recognize that. They were all last week, man. You know, I read a lot of stuff back. I mean, I read my book, and I'm like, really, did I write that? And I'll read articles I wrote a year ago. I'm like, I don't even remember writing that. And sometimes it shocks me in a good way, other times it shocks me in a bad way. But it's, you know, the problem is that, and this is the way I see the industry very much now, is that when I was younger, should I say, when I was in the industry at an earlier stage, the problem is that when I started, there was very few influencers out there. There was very few people there that you could glean good quality.
Right.
So because there was such a minimal amount, you took what they told you as almost gospel.
Yeah.
You took what they said as oh, well, we're higher in the industry than I am, therefore, what he says must be right. And there was a lot of that went on. And slowly over the years, these people, some of them have been almost ostracized to the point that nobody believes a thing they said because they made some mistakes at that time because
sure.
They were put into a position where they had to have an answer to something. It was almost this authority that was given to them. And they grasped that authority and thought, right, hold on, either I can bank this, I can sell something off the back of this, or I can, you know, use my authority to sway people in a certain direction. Now, the industry is now much different now. The problem we've got is now, instead of there being a few people doing that,
there's lots.
There are freaking thousands.
Yep.
The problem is with the invention of social media is that social media allows a platform for anybody to basically give any information out, provided they have somewhere of nurturing a following or an audience. They're going to speak to a lot of people, convince a lot of people of their beliefs, and then all of a sudden it becomes something where people look at it and go, right, that must be gospel because that person's got a million followers.
Yeah.
Now, authority is now a big issue.
Yeah.
I've been responsible and at times of using my authority to put something across that I didn't fully understand.
Sure.
And I didn't fully understand it again, just like you said.
Yep.
I told people with good intent all the time. My reasons were always very valid.
Yeah.
I've never done anything to kind of deceive someone, to push them into a corner to buy a product or whatever it might be. My intent was always good. My intent was always to help people. The problem is that I took something as gospel that wasn't gospel, and I didn't know enough about it. But because of the authority that was granted to me as a coach,
yeah.
I felt I needed to answer them.
Dude, this is gold. Yep.
So when somebody asked me a question because I didn't know the answer, I felt the need that because of the authority that's granted to me, I needed to give them some sort of answer. So I gave them an answer as best I could.
Yep. And I think
now,
so refreshing. Go on.
Whereas now, if somebody asks me a question and I don't know, I'll turn around and go, I don't know the answer to that.
Sure.
I'm sorry, I can't help.
Yep.
You know, when I do my live feeds, often and stuff, and then I'll be like, right, if I'm to generalise, or if I'm to give you the answer that maybe you're looking for, this is what I would answer. But again, I only know it based off the research I've read or the data that I know and blah, blah, blah. And then other cases, I'm like, well, I don't know enough about the subject to actually give you a valid view. But in my opinion, I would say this. Or logically, I would say this. So almost you move down the hierarchy of what information's good and what's, you know, what's good information. We've got anecdotal, we've got authority, we've got all these different, you know, ways in which we glean information from somebody. And you gradually move down the ladder until eventually you just have to go, well, what I believe is this.
Yeah.
What I know is completely different.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I don't have enough data or enough information to be able to tell you exactly what you need to know.
And this is really refreshing. Like, obviously, you know, you're an industry leader, you've made a great name for yourself, and you're happy to admit and the fact that, yeah, you might have been a little bit misled at the time. And like, you know, I've come out, I've got a lot of followers in my particular niche of over 30s men. And, you know, I believe I'm a man of integrity. And like, as I've updated my knowledge and my learnings, I can't hold it in. So I've put out emails, I've put out content, and I've gone, look, this is what I knew at the time, and perhaps, even though I was very evangelical about it, perhaps I was a little bit wrong, I was a little bit misled. That doesn't, I could keep this to myself, but I don't want to, because this is what I know now, and I think I can help you at an even greater level, you know? I'll give some sort of, we'll talk about, you know.
Well, I've got my marketing guy that, you know, they look for the stuff that had huge traction before in the past, because obviously they'll use that as an article that they'll sponsor and throw up and blah, blah,
sure,
blah, and use as a method of marketing my business. And you know, the stuff went up just recently, which was, you know, it was a 2012 article. You know, it's 5 years old.
Ooh.
Nearly 6 years
Ooh.
Old.
Ooh, yeah, yeah.
and I'm cringing because I'm saying, look, I don't want it to, you know, there's stuff in there that I just don't even agree with myself about.
Mm.
And you know, the problem is they're turning around to me going, look, it's getting huge reach, there's loads of people reading it. But again, the same questions that were getting asked from people who had a little bit more knowledge, you know, were the same questions, because they were picking up on the one thing that I wasn't comfortable with being in there.
Yeah.
And, you know, I said to them, I said, look, can we change it? He says, no, because that's doing what we wanted to do.
Sure.
It isn't bad information. It's just information that needs to be expanded on. And I used a picture of two celebrities there. And really, the honest of that was the power of celebrity.
Yes.
Go look, celebrity one, celebrity two. People believe celebrity, whatever the hell they do, you know. So people can relate to it, and they see this, and it was a really bad example, and it's there, and it's, you know, and people are reading it, and there's a lot of good information there. So I'm like, well, I'm in this sticky situation where I'm like, look, I want to take it down, but I also it's getting a lot of traction, and there's actually 90% of that is good information.
Yeah.
You know, where the 10% that I might take out and tweak and change a little bit, you know, I'm not really able to do that. So, you know, there is stuff that it does become a little cringeworthy and a little bit, you know, but your views do change, and your knowledge changes, and the stuff that we're, you know, as they say, the stuff that we're writing about now is going to be, you know, it's all hat in 2 years. It's stuff that, well, we know more now.
Yeah.
So therefore, what I wrote about 7 years ago was on point at that point.
Well, yeah.
Now it isn't. It's old. It's dated. It's, you know, the stuff that we do with the academy, I expect, you know, we have a little tab that comes up if something's been updated. So the research in it's always been looked at.
Ah.
And
I like
if
that.
If we get some new papers and stuff like this getting thrown in and the modules, we have to change the whole structure of it in many respects, because I foolishly numbered all the pages. They just ran this succession. I said, the problem is, we leave numbers on the pages, we can't update stuff.
Sure.
We can't slot stuff in. So I took the number down and rejigged the order. Obviously, threw a few people and, you know, probably annoyed a few people because they'd be printing stuff out and it's all in order and blah, blah, blah. And I said, but the reason for this is that we want to be able to update stuff and pages, take pages away if we need to, and, you know, just constantly update it. And it's very important that that's the case, because unlike a book that we buy in the industry, with it being online, we can update it permanently.
Sure, yeah.
I don't have to send it off the printer, and I'm not reading
Yeah.
So it was only printing 5 years ago, which means that size of book would probably take someone 2 years to get to actual press, get printed and blah, 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 to write it, put it together, blah, blah, blah. So you know that the date of that book is 7 years.
7 years, ago. Yeah, yeah. It's incredible.
The joy of what we've got with the internet is that stuff can be updated.
Yeah.
Not to say it isn't old, but again, if you've got an updated module on the Academy, I'll tell you when it was updated, and I'll say, look, it was updated this year.
Do you think, Phil, that we're going, like, more and more, I think we're moving into a more common sense in the industry now. And I'll give you some examples, right? For me personally, as a coach, I'm approaching my 11th year in the industry, right? For me, I've never understood. Nutrition has never been as clear to me as it is now. And what I mean by that is I went on courses, 4 or 5 years ago, and I'm not going to name any names or anything like that, because we've already said that, people were given that kind of status and they were the authority, and it was hormones, fucking don't spike insulin, gluten, is going to make you depressed, and, a spa team and detoxification and hormones and blah. And you go away over fucking whelmed, but because I've always been an enthusiastic, motivated trainer, you go home and you preach this message. And here's the thing, right? Before I got into the industry, I got fat eating a certain way, very starchy carbohydrate, lots of grains, lots of cereals. And when I got in the industry, I learned more about eating, cleaner eating or real foods. And so changed my diet around to more vegetables, more proteins. And of course, I lost weight. So immediately in my head, I labeled my previous diet as bad and this new almost paleolithic type of nutrition as good. And I've only recently sort of written an article on it, when actually there was two things that had happened that I was blissfully unaware of. First things first, I'd lost weight because I was now in a job where I wasn't sat on my ass, but I was stood on my feet all day moving more with clients. And because I fucking loved it so much, and I was 27 at the time, I was joining in with a lot of those sessions. So my activity had probably increased 150%. And secondly, I was eating less calories because I was eating more vegetables and more proteins than I was from starchy carbohydrates. So actually, I was now in a calorie deficit. And it actually had nothing to do with the food that I was originally eating being bad. So, of course, you run with it. Right, this is the way to eat, clean eating and, cut your carbs. And, and then you go on these courses and it's like detoxification, hormones. And you go so wet, so sort of down one road, almost evangelical about it. And now you look back on it 5-6 years later and think, oh, hang on. And so, how is it like that 5 years ago, and how is it like this now?
Well, because ultimately nutrition, and again, partners swear, nutrition's fucking boring.
Right.
Nutrition is boring. Nutrition is fucking boring. It's calories and it's macros. Essentially, most people that we deal with, that's all they ever need to freaking worry about. Macros and calories. And unless you invent something that is a little bit more fucking interesting, people aren't interested. Because they're like, right, no, but it needs to be this, and it needs to have a label, it needs to have a tag, it needs to have something, attached to it, it needs to have a product. What's up? No, managed to plug it out, can you hear me?
That's all right, mate, yeah, all good.
And people want to label it, they want to have something to follow. It's like, it's human nature, right? Everybody wants to follow something or be part of something. They want to be part of a club or community or whatever it might
yeah.
be, and they want to sing the praises of whatever it might be. And, we saw intermittent fasting clear, but it disappeared because for most of the people dealing with it, it's non-sustainable, you can't do it.
Right.
But for the few people that it was sustainable for, they're still cracking on doing it.
Boom, yeah.
But the people that failed it aren't preaching about it anymore because they failed. Mm. Nobody's going to preach about anything they failed at, they're just not going to do it. Gonna go, oh my god, yeah, I feel so well at this, the highest degree of success, get more PR, they get more publicity, they get more marketing,
yep.
And if our industry screams about, no, when somebody told you not to eat after 6 p.m., what happened was your calories got reduced.
Yes.
That's what happened.
When somebody told you to, when somebody told us to do nutrient timing and cut out snacks, da-da.
Your calories dropped.
Yeah.
When somebody said drop out, the stereotypical in a Western diet bread, drop out bread, you lose weight. Because most Westerners eat too much bread. And it's not too much, it's just too many calories.
Yeah.
Because what they do is they have every single meal and have bread and they have toast and bread.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they're they'll achieve what they want to achieve. And yeah, people go for that's an oversimplification. But most people don't need an overcomplication. And don't get me wrong, you know, if you want to put people on stage and you want them looking at them,
sure.
Yes.
Yeah.
There is more complicated elements to it. And yes, some things do play a role. But when you talk about things like insulin, yes, there are grounds there. There are grounds for not insulin spiking and blah, blah, blah. But really, with the vast majority of people that we as an industry deal with,
Phil, go on. No, you go on. Go on. I gotta say
that
something.
That 1%, our industry aren't even fucking dealing with.
Yeah, yeah, mate. I wrote an article about this recently. I went so down the road of sort of clean eating and worried about carbohydrate. I was worried to chew gum because I was about it spiking my insulin because of what I've been told. No, that's fucking honest, mate. That's honest. And yeah.
Blah, blah, blah. What are you on about? I mean, it isn't, and even if it did, it's not going to matter that much.
Yeah, yeah. I remember going on courses, and it was like a fat loss courses, and the course instructor said, you know, a lot of people just think that it's all down to, you know, fat loss is down to calories in versus calories out, but it's a whole lot more complex than that. And then, you know, the whole, you know, whole weekend was about hormones and insulin and detoxification and this and this and this, and you just go fuck, you know.
Again, a lot of it's valid. The problem is that we're applying it to the wrong people. You know, you're worried about someone insulin spiking who's eating 9,000-10,000 calories every weekend, but insulin spiking ain't the problem. Problem is the big cheaters.
Yes.
That's the problem.
Yeah.
You know. And it's not, and the problem is that we're dealing with people from a perspective of what we want. You know, I run a fat loss seminar that's, you know, it's 8 hours essentially of me talking about fat loss. You know how much I talk about food and insulin spiking and hormones?
No.
And all that? I don't.
Fuck all.
I don't. You know, don't get me wrong. 10 years ago, I would have.
Yeah.
Because it was the sort of thing that people wanted to know about. Don't get me wrong. If somebody wants to know about something in this industry, we'll do our best to teach them. So in the academy, when people ask them, can you tell me about carb cycling? I'm like, yeah, I can tell you about carb cycling, but I can also tell you how to apply it,
yeah,
who it applies to, and what relevance it's going to have. And actually, in the grand scheme of things, what impact it's going to have on someone. And yes, it has a place. Unfortunately, if you're gonna tell carb cycling as the thing to do, you're talking to a very small percentage of people.
Sure.
That are actually going to see a significant difference. Because at the end of the day, all carb cycling is taking the same amount of carbs you have over the course of a week, giving yourself high and low days.
Yeah.
All it is. Because it's still going to look at calories and talk about carbohydrates that you put in. All you're doing is you're spending some days with glycogen levels low, days with glycogen levels high. You know, and it isn't any more complicated than that. But people want to overcomplicate things to be different. And they want to stand out because, you know, somebody told me this, and what's happened here is my insulin levels get spiked and blah, 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 my nutrient timing is
again. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. There is validity, and I tell you what, I can't ever deny that there isn't, but how relevant is it to the population that we as a whole as an industry are dealing with? Because I tell you what, you know, fat Phil at 14 years old wouldn't have benefited from any of it.
No, absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
I needed someone to find a way to prevent me eating as many calories and get me off my arse more. In fact, to be honest, they didn't even need to get me off my arse more, because I tell you what, I was the most active kid you could ever imagine.
Sure, and me, yeah.
You know, and it wasn't about that, but the problem was is these were behaviours, there were habits that were instilled into me for, you know, and my fat loss seminars, I spent most of the time talking about, you know, the behaviours.
Yes.
People, what it's like to walk in this person's shoes, and I always use Bob as an example. I use Bob as my, you know, stereotypical overweight bloke who goes out with his mates on a Friday night. And anybody who's been to any of my seminars or heard me talk, well, chances are they've probably heard of Bob.
Yeah.
And above this bloke who goes out with his mates and blah, blah, blah. The fact is that most people don't want to live the way our industry perceives they want to live. You know, people don't want to eat food out.
Tell the story about Bob, because you told me and it's fucking brilliant. Go on.
But they don't. People don't want to eat out of Tupperware all day. People want to eat a pizza once a week. You know, people want to go out, socialise with friends and have a couple of drinks. And the problem is, what you're doing is you're saying, oh, it's life-changing being leaner. No, it isn't. It's life-changing when you ban someone for doing all the shit they enjoy. That's life-changing. And it's not a positive thing. You know, it's not a positive thing for most people. And don't get me wrong, there are lifestyles where people enjoy their life without drinking, without socialising, without all this shit. But that's not the people we're dealing with for the most part. You know, and it's this thing where, you know, everybody's banging, they're all up in uproar because of this gym chain in America. And I talk about this from a business perspective. And the fastest growing gym chain in America is Planet Fitness, right? Planet Fitness is always in uproar in our industry because everybody's going, oh my God, they give free pizzas away every month to all the members. You know, what example are we trying to set? What we're trying to set an example where you hypocrite, are telling people that they can't have a pizza once a month.
Yeah.
And we have the most hypocritical industry. But the fact is, the vast majority of people and coaches in our industry are off secretly eating ice cream and pizza.
Yep.
The fact is, they just don't tell anybody.
Yeah.
You know, they want what everybody else wants, but the problem is, they think hiding it is a good thing. No, that's disordered.
No, yeah.
That's disordered.
Dude, I've been there.
It's an eating disorder. If you know, and you get it where people in the industry that dump themselves in their rooms and all the dominoes in, and spend the weekend binge eating, and then because they validate on a Monday morning by going,
cheat meal.
Yeah.
Phil, you're talking about me. You're talking about me a couple of years ago. It's complete mirror. Yeah.
But the industry does that. We have an industry full of people who have disordered eating patterns.
Yeah.
We do.
Well, the
problem. We're in the worst culprits. I standing flat on seminars, you can see people looking at it going, oh my God, that's me.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Well, I think trying to be an ultra clean eater was. It was easy for me 6 years ago before the kids come along, living on my own with no stresses, no fucking anything, and just able to nip into Tesco every night and pick up chicken and broccoli. But I just wrote an article now. When my life turned 360 degrees, I had two kids quickly. I went VAT registered. I fucking took on staff and moved to a big house, and I didn't sleep for 3 years. And I was trying to be the ultimate clean eater, and lasting about 3 days before ending up in a 6-bag of crisps, 4 Mars bars and 5 cans because I'd eaten a slice of bread. That's how bad it got for me.
Yeah.
Whereas if I'd just allowed myself a little bit, maybe I'd have gotten through that without binging.
But it's that fucking mentality everybody has, like, oh my God, I've screwed that thing up, my lunch carry going, and I'll start again on Monday.
Yeah.
Like, no. What it is that as an industry, we need to actually consider the person to deal with. You know, because if you get people who are like dying, they're like, you've got to eat a 7, you've got to eat a 10, you've got to eat a 1, you've got to eat a 4, you've got to eat a such and such. Like, right, meal frequency, why? You know, when we look at it, really, the grand scheme of things, somebody who is active and training and trying to change their physique, 4 meals a day is all they need. And that's to do with protein turnover. And you ask any nutritionist, you ask any dietitian, they're going to say 4. Because the turnover of protein is going to be like 6 to 8 hours, which means that you are going to run out of protein at some point. When you do, we're going the wrong way.
Yeah.
So if you give someone 4 meals, that's a bare minimum. Done. Easy. Why do bodybuilders eat 6 meals? It's not because they're leaner and it's still because they're metabolism. It's because they need to eat more frigging food because they're bigger than you.
Yeah.
It's very hard to eat 4,000 calories in 4 meals.
Yeah.
You can't do it. So therefore they eat more. It's got nothing to do with, but the associated look at bodybuilders and go, they eat 6 meals and they're leaner. No. They're also carrying about 10 pounds more muscle tissue than you are.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they need to eat more food to sustain that mass. Oh, I don't want to look like that. Like, well, you're not going to wake up one morning just looking like that. It ain't going to happen. You know, so and there's all these kind of speculations as to, you know, you've got to eat at this time. I'm like, no, you eat when you can. You know, if I'm dealing with a client, they don't want to eat breakfast, they don't eat breakfast.
Yeah.
They want to eat breakfast, they eat breakfast. You know, really, in the grand scheme of things, is it going to make any difference if they eat at 10 or they eat at 6 o'clock when they get up?
Yeah.
No. It isn't in the grand scheme of things, but I'm not going to take something that's been habitual for them their entire life and change it by just telling them. I'm going to look at all the contextual cues, the reasons why they do things. I'm going to look at all the behaviours. I'm going to look at all those things. I'm going to consider the fact they've got kids. I'm going to consider the fact they haven't got kids. I'm going to consider the fact they've got a 9 to 5 job, we're going to consider the fact that they have a shift working pattern. I'm going to consider all of this stuff. But I'll tell you what, the amount of coaches that do consider it are few and far between.
Sure.
They tell you what you've got to do and then leave you with this program that doesn't fit your lifestyle, doesn't fit your life, doesn't fit your habits. There's a list of things there that you don't actually freaking like. You know, there's and all this, and it's a lack of consideration for the people that we deal with.
I think the thing is, Phil, is you have to treat everyone as an individual. And I remember years ago, if you know, this was before the kids come along, before I had any stress in my life. If somebody couldn't remain eating clean 100% of the time, I would say, well, what's wrong with you, right? And now I look back and I just think, fucking hell, like, what was I talking about? And, you know, there's something, I work with over 30s men, a lot of them are over 40s, I work with successful guys, just like you have, Phil, and you know what? I'm never going to stop them having a pint on the weekend. It doesn't matter what I tell them during the week, it doesn't matter how much I go on, these guys like a beer on the weekend. And I used to kind of almost beat myself up thinking, why can't I change them? And now I think, well, fucking hell, why should I? If that's what they want to do, all I can do is work with them, is work with them and show them how they can go out and still have a couple of drinks and hopefully get results, right?
Yeah. Which is what they want, right?
Yeah.
But you listen, they told you, this right now is what I want for my life. I'm going to be able to go out and come to beer. You're not going to change their life and tell them that all of a sudden now, instead of spending their adult lives having a beer with the mates at weekend, you're going to tell them, no, you're not allowed to do that anymore. And don't get me wrong, they might turn around to you when they've lost a bit of weight, this, that, the other, and they might turn around to you and say, look, Mark, fact is, I don't really see the value in that beer anymore, you know, because I'm getting in shape, I'm enjoying it, I'm feeling much better about myself, I'm feeling fitter, and to be honest, I just go out and drink for the sake of it, and it's just something I've always done. And right now, you know, my wife's expecting, whatever this story might be, you know, we're going to have a kid soon and I'm not going to be able to do it then as much and blah, blah, blah. I just want to knock the beer on the head. Is that okay by you, coach? And you'll be like, yeah, fine. But obviously, we're not writing that off. We're just saying that you're choosing not to do that anymore. And that's cool. You know, we can fit that in and we can structure that into your diet, which means that all of a sudden now you're not having 5 beers on a Friday night, which means you can have 1,000 calories somewhere else.
Boom. Congratulations. Yep.
You know? And it's working with what people want. And at the end of the day, we're catering to people's needs and wants. And, you know, you look at the two most successful weight loss platforms on the planet. Again, I could be wrong statistically.
Okay.
As far as I know, the two biggest platforms on the planet are Weight Watchers and Slimming World. And
yep.
Whatever anybody says about them, you know, people have lost more weight with those two systems than probably any coach in the world ever achieved.
Yep.
Now, what is the one characteristic about most of those that stands out is that they allow people to eat the food they like.
Yeah. Brilliant.
That's why they succeed. Because they're not shy with the whole... And why they succeed in the business is because they take those same foods that people like, and they'll go like, oh, God, a lot of the people that we deal with like to eat chocolate brownies. So what we're going to do is we're going to get a chocolate brownie, find a way of shaving a few calories off, stick it in a Weight Watchers box and sell it to them. Now, all of a sudden, we've got that customer instead of somebody else who's selling brownies.
Genius.
That's good business, you know. And all I had to do was actually, right, we're going to get a food company to make us some brownies, but then what they're going to do is they're going to shave a little bit of the calories off it, which at the end of the day is rocket science, you know. You can get pizza from Pizza Hut, and you can shave 250 to 300 calories off it by asking for half the cheese.
Yep.
You know, and I'm not saying that's something you should do, but what I'm saying is that it's very easy to reduce calories per meal. People don't do that. They're like, oh, well, you know, we've now eating chicken and fish every meal and broccoli and this, that, and that. The end of the day, if I'm basically, you know, in the last fat loss, let me use an example. The last fat loss seminar, I said to people that were there, I said, give me a amount of calories the average person, you know, for somebody who's active, somebody who's training 3-4 times a week, somebody threw up a number, I can't remember, it was something like 2,200 calories. I'm like, cool, right, brilliant. So the next most important number to us is protein, because there's a training population, protein is very, very important, and obviously protein can be converted to carbs if we need it too, blah, blah, blah. So we've ascertained protein. So I think it was something like 2,200 calories, 140 grams of protein, something like that. And I said, right, how many meals can this person eat? Not how many meals do we think they can eat, how many meals can this person eat based on their working schedule? So they've gone, right, 4. So I said, right, let's divide 2,200 by 4, let's divide the protein by 4. Now, you're going to give them a day's plan of eating. And I said, we can do this on the internet in about 30 seconds. And I said, right, where are they eating first thing? So they're walking to work, they're passing the McDonald's. I said, find me some McDonald's. I'm meal has got, say, 600 calories in it, say, 5 grams of protein, done. They find it in seconds.
Wow.
I said, next meal, they're going to go to a press. So their office is next to a press. So I want you to find me 600 calories, 35 grams of protein, but they can't find it. They find it. I said, right, evening meal, on the way home, they're going to drop by Marks and Spencer's. Go to Marks and Spencer's, find me a meal, 600 calories, 35 grams of protein, bang, done. And I think, and then we get a supper. And I said, the supper, they're actually going to make their own food, because the rest of the day they didn't have time.
Sure.
Clearly. So we give them stuff that they can get on the hop from wherever they are passing or wherever they're at. Then we get the evening meal, I think we did like home or something like that. I said, so when they're at Marks and Spencer's buying their dinner, they also buy their supper. So we structured this meal, and all of a sudden this person's hitting their calories, they're hitting their macros, they're eating food that is relatively healthy.
Tasty as well.
In the grand scheme, they've got to pick what food they freaking want. And I think it ended up, they had it was a bacon and egg muffin or something like that for breakfast. They
Brilliant.
They had some kind of salad, I think it was from Pret, some kind of like avocado crayfish salad or something along those lines. For dinner, they picked spaghetti bolognese. Then for their supper, they had an omelette with some ham and some cheese and various other bits.
Wow.
And basically, I got the coaches to construct it. And I'll tell you what, it took us about 3 minutes.
Brilliant.
To figure all of this out. So just jump online, find the macros, because you can find the macros for us.
Yep.
And I said, you try and tell me that isn't, in the grand scheme of things, a pretty damn healthy diet.
Yep.
You know?
And not just that, somebody's going to adhere to it.
Yeah, and the fact is it's convenient for them.
Yep.
I've made the first 3 meals of their day convenient for them. You know, and that as a coach is good coaching. You know, I've told them, like, that you've got to wake up an hour early to make your breakfast.
Oh, yeah, fucking up.
Smoked salmon, scrambled eggs, and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And then you've got to
Tupperware.
Make your lunch from somewhere, take it to work in a Tupperware container, eat it cold, you know, all wilted and...
Yeah, it's refreshing. This is such a refreshing approach. And I'll tell you one thing as well, Phil. One thing I've said to people is, for me, I've always struggled with overeating. If I was preparing 6 meals a day, that's going to lead me to overeat, because I've got access to more food right at my fingertips when I'm preparing that, right?
Yeah.
So there's no need.
There isn't a second, and I always use this example. There is barely a human being on this planet right now in the Western world that could not find food within 45 seconds.
Yeah.
And, you know, we talk a lot about hedonic foods and hyper-palatable foods, and the food that you are liking is a human being to overeat. And your problem is you can't practice it. People say, yeah, but I'm addicted to chocolate. I'm like, okay, so I'm going to put some 90% chocolate in front of you. Are you addicted to it? But, oh, actually, no, I'm not.
Yeah.
You told me you're addicted to chocolate. That's chocolate. But there's a million variations of chocolate, and there's certain ones that you know you can't control when you start eating them. They'll be the ones you pick. So what we do is we say, right, we take the ones away that you generally pick and overeat that have be hyper-palatable and hedonic foods, and we'll replace them with something that you can control.
Yep, yes.
Now all of a sudden that person's eating chocolate, but they're controlling their intake. Wow. Now all of a sudden they're empowered. Now all of a sudden they're in charge of their own choices. And they know full well, because they were the people that identified to me that the whole of dairy milk was the one that they're likely to overeat on.
Yep.
So what we do is, right, so you're just going to have dairy milk. Yeah, but I don't really like that as much. I said, yeah, but do you like it? Yeah, I love it. But I'm not going to overeat on it. So when I tell you to eat, you know, 3 squares of it, 3 squares is fine.
Yeah.
Whereas the whole nut, you're so used to, and it's been ingrained so many times that you never, ever, in the last 5 years, picked up a whole nut bar.
Dude.
The whole friggin' thing.
Dude, and this is so refreshing to be able to speak it like this. And, you know, you've mentioned McDonald's, you've mentioned Pret, you've mentioned the odd bit of chocolate. Like, who would have thought that you can still eat these things and get results? Because I know the courses that I was on 5 years ago, this stuff would have just been, you know, no, you mustn't eat this stuff. And then, of course, what do you want to do? You want to go away and fucking smash it and binge on it and feel guilty and then...
But it's all mentality. And the thing is that you look at McDonald's compared now to what it was 5, 6 years ago.
Absolutely.
Right? And the problem is that they get called up when their food's shit. And what they have to do is they have to move with the times.
Yeah.
Is that they have to have good quality ingredients, they have to have good quality produce, they have to have good quality everything. Because ultimately that influences the taste of the food. We know this.
Yeah.
Now, they can't cut corners like they used to. And again, I'm using McDonald's as an example. But, you know, you look at ready meals. I remember ready meals, Mark, when I was in school. And it was like a treat to have a ready meal. There was this microwave, because microwaves, again, were a fairly new thing. And it was like, you could stick this TV dinner in this microwave, and it was shit. It was the worst quality food you could ever imagine. But it was tasty, and it was lovely, and
Yeah.
Martin Spencer. You go into Martin Spencer's, you find a meal, it will go off in 2 to 3 days. That means everything in it is whole food.
Yes.
It's real, it's genuine, it's fresh. It's going to expire in several days. Because no one's pissed around with the enzymes in it, nobody's refined it, nobody's done anything, you know, on a molecular level.
That's interesting.
Nobody's done shit with it, nobody's added anything to it. It's freaking food. It's vegetable, it's meat, it's dairy, it's whatever it might be, but it's in its raw form, which means it expired. You used to be able to buy cheap meat in it, and they would go out for a century.
Yep.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Good.
This is the difference. People are eating fresh foods, and companies like this can't compete now unless they do that.
Yeah.
You know, you can go down to your local cafe, and you know the quality of what they're serving is better than it probably was, because, you know, they know that the crappy cheap eggs don't taste quite as good as the more expensive, lovely tasting eggs. But if they source it right, they can get it just as cheap because they buy it from a farm down the road. You know, and it's the world's a different place with nutrition than
yes.
10 years ago. In another 10 years, it will be again.
I know, and I think right now, Phil. You know, we were talking about this before. Every place you go to, you're going to get the macro breakdown and the calories, right? Pretty much everywhere.
Pretty much, yeah.
So,
chances are you're going to find a very close estimate as to what it is.
Yeah. And I think in the sort of, you know, in this age of sort of MyFitnessPal and, you know, your Fitbits and your Garmins, I mean, I wear a Fitbit. It's helped me massively. I really believe that the calorie expenditure output is out, but I just use it for my steps and MyFitnessPal included. There's never been a better time, really, to be able to sort of track your intake. Would you agree?
It hasn't, but again, MyFitnessPal, they shoot themselves in the foot because, again, that's customer-driven. You understand what I mean by that?
Go on.
Whereas MyFitnessPal, when it first launched, MyFitnessPal, they gathered the data from reputable sources. Now what you can do with MyFitnessPal is if I'm looking for a food and I can't find it on their mark, I can put the calories in and the macros in. I can put it in and then what that does is that populates the database. So imagine if I've gone in and input the food and I've got one digit wrong. So I go in and I've input this food and I'm updating their site, and a lot of their foods that are on their site have been put there by their consumers.
Right, okay.
You and me.
So yes.
A lot of their data now is out. It isn't accurate. So this is the problem. And again, this is their way of almost cutting a corner. Going back
right.
And again, I don't... It's if it's driven by the people that use it. So therefore, there is data in there that is a miss and isn't as accurate as it should be.
Sure.
This is where it's coaching me that you've got to use reputable.
Interesting. Very interesting.
Databases or do it for ourselves in many respects. So, there are sources out there, but we need to, like anything, we've got to know where the source is. Where did it come from? Where did that information come from? Because I tell you what, if I was using my Fitnessbar, I wouldn't know exactly where that information's coming from.
That's really interesting. That's something I'm not considered for.
I found out it came from Dave, from Milk King, who saw it on the back of the packet, but he misread it slightly and thought it had 30 grams of protein when in fact it's only got 3.
I'm with you, bud. So... You obviously track your map. We're going to have about another 5 minutes, Phil, if that's right, because I know you're a very busy man, and I know that you were telling me your daughter gets home from school. Sure, you're brilliant. You're such a passionate guy, mate. I really appreciate it. So let's quickly talk about your nutrition, your macros, etc. You obviously track, right? But you're obviously not using MyFitnessPal after that comment. Yeah, you track him. Yeah, sorry. Well, I don't know. You told me before you're on protein-wise and calorie-wise. I mean...
No, but that means I track, right?
Right.
That means I know what I should be eating.
Sure.
And I know what I need. And there's a difference there. Again, I'm talking about... I'm a very experienced person.
Yeah.
So I know I can look at food and I can tell you pretty much what's in them.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the time, because I've dealt with that for a long, long time. I've looked at information so many times. I can tell you what's in an egg, I can tell you what's in chicken breast, I can tell you all that stuff. You know, I won't be far off. Sometimes I might be, but other times I won't. So I have a good estimation, a good idea of what I need on a day-to-day basis. But my goal every day, Mark, is that I'm happy with my physique.
Yeah.
And don't get me wrong, the mornings I wake up, I look in the mirror, I go, oh, shit, no, I'm not looking clever today. But I'll tell you what, as of age, I'm like, right, my physique is a result of the lifestyle I choose to live.
Sure.
If my lifestyle changes slightly, my physique also changes slightly. So over the course of the summer, there's been some more barbecue.
Yeah, and you got married, haven't you, as well? Recently got married.
Yeah, I am indeed, yes. And you know, we both eat very, very well. And there are times where I'll get comfort. You know, I have a company that delivers my food a lot of the time, so again, that makes it easy for me. But then I get a bit bored sometimes with their food, and then I'll go to Marks & Spencer, and I get all my food from there. And I'm not tracking. I don't put food into an app every
right.
single day. I
Interesting.
Don't do that.
Yep.
To be honest, I can't remember last time I did that. But I can pick up a piece of food, or I can pick up something, and I know ballpark how many calories it's got in it.
Yep.
Is it too high? Is it too low? And then if it's too high, the next meal I'll compensate and have something slightly less. You know, I'm very aware of what I'm consuming, and that's awareness. So am I tracking? Yeah, I guess I am. Am I consciously tracking?
Sure.
No, I'm subconsciously tracking.
And no, I mean,
I'm not writing it down. I'm not being pedantic about whether something's got 500 calories or 600.
Yeah.
I know ballpark what I can eat. There'll be times where I'll pick up a piece of food and I go, oh my God, I can eat two of them.
Yeah.
You know, or if I eat that, I can have a chocolate bar alongside. And I'm still good.
Well, do you know one thing that's been an absolute bloody game changer for me whilst I've been dieting recently is fucking fruit pastel lollies, dude. 60 calories, and now I'm no longer concerned about the insulin fairy coming out to get me. Let me tell you that when you're dieting, two or three of them on a Saturday night is fucking wonderful. It's just a joy. And I'm even enjoying the odd Diet Coke again now because I know, well, I know more. Do you know what I mean? I know one Diet Coke isn't going to kill me.
We have a fridge full of Pepsi Max all the time. You know, I like a can of Pepsi Max now and again.
Yeah.
Pepsi Max is my one to go for. You know, and it doesn't cause me problems. I'm not smashing tons of it every day. I'm still drinking litres of
yes.
water as well.
Yes.
But when I want something a little bit sweet on my palate, I'm like, right, I'm going to grab a Pepsi Max. I'm going to have it.
Yeah.
We have sugar-free, you know, salad dressings. We have sugar-free this, that, the other. Yeah, we've got some sweeteners in them. But again, you know, I'm not consuming vast amounts of this stuff.
The danger's in the dosage, right?
Absolutely, and I'm not going to be, you know, and some of it leaves a funny aftertaste, in which case it gets thrown in the bin, you know, because I want my food to taste good. I'm not going to jeopardise taste for anything else. You know, yesterday we knocked up, you know, we had mozzarella, tomato, basil, we had fresh olive oil on it, we had a little bit of balsamic vinegar on it, you know, and then the balsamic syrup. And we had some fresh cod.
Fantastic.
Know, threw that in the oven. The rest of it I just sliced up, stuck on a plate, done. You know, and it's great food. You know, and calorie-wise, I would have no clue what was in there. But I tell you what, it's not going to be over 600 calories.
Sure. And you know that you're in the gym every day. You're moving well. You're drinking plenty of water. And again, you know.
Yep.
It's like we said, that there should be no food group off limits. And, you know, these little, what we previously thought were treats. I remember this was an absolute nugget you said to me last time. I referred to it as junk food. And you said, Tregs, it's not junk food. It's slightly less nourishing, higher calorie food. And that really fucking resonated and stuck with me, dude.
But it is. It's like, you know, if I want something, I eat it. You know, but I also need to accept the consequences of that. And I'm not going to beat myself up and I'm not going to sit in the corner and cry because I'm just eating the chocolate bar. I'm not going to do that because at the end of the day, I ate it because I wanted it and I ate it because I wanted to enjoy it. You know, the problem is that certain things I know, if I pick them up, they're gone. If I buy a pack of rice cakes, chocolate covered rice cakes, it's a bizarre.
Oh, mate, trigger foods. Trigger foods.
I've used this example before. A digestive biscuit, a chocolate covered digestive biscuit, is calorically pretty much identical to a rice cake with chocolate on top of it. But the perception is it's healthy for you. But at the end of the day, I will quite happily give up a chocolate digestive for a rice cake.
Yeah.
I love chocolate covered rice cakes.
Me too.
Like, well, you put a packet in front of me, I'll eat all of them.
Yeah.
You know, and I will. So therefore, you know, one of the rules, well, not a rule, but when we're out in the supermarket, I'm like, do I really want one? Because if I do, I know the packet's probably.
You've got to factor in those whole packet of calories, yeah.
and that's not a willpower thing. That's the fact that's what I enjoy.
Yeah.
If I ate one rice cake, I wouldn't enjoy it.
Yeah.
Because I have that. You know, that element of restriction about it. If I'm going to eat them, I'm going to eat the whole packet because that's what I do with them.
Yeah.
So what do? I don't buy them.
Yeah.
I don't buy them. And when I do choose to buy them, I eat the packet. I thoroughly enjoy it.
And you enjoy it and you know about it, yeah.
I make sure there isn't 7 days worth of rice cake.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, it's prevention, and people are too busy looking at. And it's an analogy. It's a phrase we use in the world of, you know, when we look at rehab for injuries and things like this. A lot of times we use the term the victim and the culprit. So, you know, when people have got a bad back, you know, the low back, the vast majority of the time the back is the victim. It's not the culprit.
Yeah.
So you don't then go after the culprit. You don't go after the victim. You know, so someone with a bad lower back, they go to a GP, and again, this authority thing we were talking about earlier.
Yep.
They go to a GP, they've got a bad back, the GP is your back's not strong enough, which is bollocks.
Yep.
Human beings that never ever really, unless they've had a joint problem, whatever it might be, most human beings' lower backs are going to be strong as fuck because they spend most of their flexion, which means the lower back is taking most of the load. Most of them have gluteal problems where the glutes don't fire like
yep.
So all it, and we spend most of our time as human beings bending over doing things. Our lower backs are not going to be weak. If anything, they're going to be way too strong for all your joint structures. So therefore, the lower back is the victim. But you go to the wrong person, they're going to go, oh, well, you're painting your lower back, therefore that must be where the problem is. So make it stronger and you'll be fine. Bullshit. The culprits are the glutes, the hamstrings, the lats, and the role of the coach, the role of the physio, and the, you know, whoever it is that's dealing, is to find out what are the culprits.
Yeah.
Not who the victim is. We know who the fucking victim is. The person's got a bad back. We need to know what the culprits are, why they're a culprit. Are they too strong? Are they too much tone in them? Are they too tight? What's the problem? So, and this is the same, is that we're not looking at diets. We're always blaming something.
Certain foods, yeah.
And it isn't. The fucking culprit is the fact that that's what you associate with that food. You know, you have a contextual cue as to why you eat that food. You know, you go to the cinema and eat popcorn.
Yeah.
What do you do? You deal with going to the cinema.
Yeah.
If you stop people going to the cinema and stop eating fucking popcorn.
Brilliant.
You point out to them the fact that is why you eat popcorn.
Yeah.
The problem is, you look at a tub of popcorn from the cinema, you're talking about 2,500 calories.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
You know?
But.
And you ain't coming back from that.
You're not coming back. No, you ain't coming back from that. I like it. Yeah.
Well, you're not, right?
Yeah, but do you know what I find really interesting is I actually ended up with regards to going back to this whole trying to be too clean and, you know, alienating certain foods, eliminating certain foods is, you know, my binges became so epic. I had to go and have some therapy for it because it was just getting so bad. It wasn't just for the food. It was for lots of other stuff going on in my life, like having two kids in the space of 16 months and fucking not having any sleep. And the first thing the guy said to me was, why are you limiting those foods? Why don't you just have a pack? Why don't you just have a packet of crisps or a chocolate bar or a lolly? And I was like, what? I can't do that. I mean, it's fucking... Okay. And then you actually look back and it's like you said earlier, you realise how disordered it is. How disordered.
And the food industry doesn't help, but at the end of the day, their incentive is to make food tasty as hell, get people to buy it, and also improve profit margins. So in many respects, you look at like a bag of crisps, and bag of crisps put on the 80% hair.
Right.
You know? So people think they're buying more than they were. So actually, the calories
yeah.
go down.
Yeah, yeah.
They've done the same in chocolate bars. The chocolate bars are smaller than ever before. You look at the Boston, the Brexit has done this. And if you know, if you pay attention to this, cereal boxes have got smaller.
Right. Right.
Very quickly. Because now what they're doing is they're going, hold on, we need to get our margins back to where they were. So now we're getting charged more for the product in its raw format.
Right.
What we're gonna do is we're actually just gonna make the cereal boxes smaller. So people think they're buying the same thing, but they're not. It's smaller.
Wow.
You know, you look around supermarkets, a lot of it's changed. And you know, this is maybe partly to do with the Brexit, but it's also companies, you know, trimming margins, and you look at things that disappear, that all of a sudden you're like, hold on, you know, my gym had that equipment last week, now it's gone. So they've discreetly kind of moved to people because they want to improve their margins, you know, and it's business, and the food industry is about business, and at the end of the day, if I'm going to produce some food to sell to somebody, I want it to be friggin' tasty.
Yeah.
The day, that's the reason they eat it. You know, you look at the defining characteristic of why you eat most food, you eat it because they're tasty.
Tasty, yep.
You know, so if you can make something, you know, tasty, but also within your macros,
yep.
calories, good for you.
Yep.
Holy shit, you're on to a winner.
But mate,
you know?
I can't believe, you know, since I understood macros and calories, you know, my favorite chocolate bar is a whole nut. And I know now that is 245 calories. And if I want one, I'll just factor it in. I also know, like you, if I've got a bit of a sweet tooth and maybe I've ran out of calories today, I'll have a Diet Coke. There's nothing in it. Or if I've got a little bit to play around with, I'll have a fruit pastel lolly. And, you know, I don't want people to now think, oh, Treggs is out and, you know, Phil is advocating just eating pure junk. No, you know, you need to be getting lots of fresh vegetables and good quality protein and lots of water. But we're talking about allowing for those things, right?
Far from it. And the problem is that there's somebody out there right now listening to this, snapping their feet, going, oh my God, how dare they? And the problem is that they're a fence sitter. They're one person on one side of a view, and what they're doing is they're not contemplating the fact that, don't get me wrong, hey, if I could get every single person on this planet to eat clean food as we perceive it,
yep.
Clean food is tasty and this, that, and the other. But at the end of it, a chicken breast doesn't taste good. It smells horrendous. You know, and if you put a bit of sauce with it, you make it taste, you cook it well, yep. You know, it's not cold side Tupperware all day. It, all of a sudden, it's appealing.
Yep.
It's tasty. It's something that you actually thoroughly enjoy eating. You know, it's like going to a restaurant and you order a dish with it, just a chicken breast. And it's got the skin on it, it's been cooked really nicely, the bone's still in it, and it's this lovely piece of cooked food. And it's been seasoned nicely. And at the end of the day, it's exactly the same as that bland piece that you eat every day at home. But the problem is, the vast majority of people can't cook, so therefore, you know, and again, going back on our previous comment, the thing where we structure the diet for people, you look at something like that, the vast majority of people can't cook, firstly. Secondly, the vast majority don't want to cook. That's a big factor.
Yeah.
Thirdly, most people don't have the time to cook. And so you create this illusion that somebody's going to go home every night and spend 2 hours prepping. The food is nonsense. It's a bodybuilder mentality.
Yeah.
You look at most, and again, no disrespect to the bodybuilding community. Again, I know a lot of friends and blah, 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 them. And some of them will laugh about this. Some of them might get up on the high horse about it. But at the end of the day, that has been taken from a bodybuilding community. The vast majority of people in the bodybuilding community have a very selfish side to the way they live their lives. And that involves a complete lifestyle change.
Yes.
You go home every single night, irrespective of whether your kids are hungry or whatever it might be. You have to sit there and prep your own food.
Yeah.
And that is something that you have to factor into your lifestyle.
Yes.
And you have to factor in that when the family meets, you've got to do something different.
Oh, mate. Yeah.
But the majority of people we deal with don't want to be professional bodybuilders. And somebody picked the question on one of the social media pages that I have the other day, and they said about, you know, some lady was to do with a trainer, and I said, really, the biggest question here is she going to do this professionally? Because at the end of the day, what she's proposing to do is life changing.
Yes.
And the way she's choosing to live her life is a very selfish thing that she has got to go.
And that's their choice if they want to do it, yeah.
And at the end of the day, I'm not taking that choice away from her. But I'm just saying to her, look, if you make this choice, this is a complete lifestyle change, and this is something that's going to impact your friends, your family, your the social circles you live in. And this is bodybuilding, right? You look at bodybuilding, a lot of your friends are written out because your friends are your friends because you've got something they relate to and you can no longer relate to it. You know, your family, they don't get it. You know, and you can sit down and be blue in the face. Unless they've done it for themselves, they don't get it because it all seems a bit strange. It's like as Arnold said in Pumping Iron. I always remember the line where he talked about, you know, bodybuilding. He said, what a lot of people don't get is that me, the concept of driving a car round and round in circles on the track doesn't make sense. Doesn't make sense to me. But what he's saying, obviously, it makes sense for a lot of other people because that's their thing.
Yes.
You know, and this is how when we deal with clients, we're going to look at what sense does it make? And our role as advisors is to make them look at it from a slightly different perspective. It's the amount of people that I've seen in the last 2 to 3 years who've gone away, done bodybuilding competitions, figure competitions, physique competitions, came out on the other side in a horrendous state.
Yeah, yeah.
Physically, mentally, psychologically, emotionally. And a year later, they're regretting every single piece of it.
Yep. And there is another way. There is another way. And it doesn't have to be as extreme, right? And I've done that. I've tried that. I've tried that, you know, 6 meals a day, Tupperware, chicken, broccoli, and it just ended up in a bad way for me.
Mate, I lived like that for about 10 years.
Social occasions, you know, Phil. I used to fucking dread them. And then once I had, you know, one slice of pizza, it's game over. I'm going to eat more than any fucker there.
I'm like, sorry, I can't come to your birthday party.
No.
Most of tweeted their birthday cake. I'm like, oh, okay. So hold on. You're not going to go to your close birthday party because you're going to be forced to eat a piece of cake. So I don't get that. But there were times, don't get me wrong, Mark, in my life where I did get that.
Yeah.
Look, I didn't think I had an option. Didn't think I had a choice. So that was the only choice I was led to believe I could make. You know, the only thing I could do was say no. The easiest way for me to prevent somebody putting me under peer pressure to eat a slice of cake was just avoid the whole situation.
Yeah. It's funny, isn't it, when you look back and you realise how kind of disordered that is, you know, a disordered way to live a life. And it's like you said, there's only a very small minority of people that can do that. And fucking hell, 100% hats off to them. But it's like you said, the general public, they don't want to live like that.
But Mark, it's a choice. And I'm not one to go, look, you shouldn't be a bodybuilder. I might, look, if that's what you want, because that's how you want to live your life, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. If you take great pleasure out of it and enjoy it thoroughly, you love being in that competition,
yep,
that challenge, and you love all of that, go for it. 100%. 100%.
Yep.
But before you make that decision, don't get caught up with the concept of it. You've got to understand it. You've got to understand what you're getting yourself,
yes,
into.
Yes.
And you've got to understand what limitations you have with what you're doing. And you've got to understand that it's not life changing, but it's something that over the course of the year, you're not going to get that time back.
No.
You're not going to get a chance to do that again. You're not going to get a chance. And I see more people regret it than appreciate it or love it. And, you know, that's just from my experience in the industry. And I don't want people doing things that are going to have this negative outcome, this horrendous, horrible outcome.
Yes.
And
the rebound.
Every diet has its place.
Yeah.
Every diet has its place. Every lifestyle has its place. But we've got to remember about the people we're dealing with. The people we're dealing with, most of them don't want to be bodybuilders. Most of them don't want to live like bodybuilders. Most of them can't train like bodybuilders. Most of them can't, you know, the concept. They like the concept of being fit and shredded and blah, blah, blah. But at the end of the day, we've also got to consider the lifestyle. We've got to be, as coaches, very honest with these people. We've got to say to them, look, at the end of the day, you've got X amount of time or whatever it might be to get in that shape. Then what's going to happen after it?
Sure.
You know, I'm training someone now, and you know, we said I can't divulge too much about it, but I'm training now, and this is a life changing event.
Right.
And the reason I'm saying it's a life changing event for this kid, this is a life changing event.
Right.
Which means that we've got 10 weeks, and he needs to do everything I can.
Sure. Sure. Yeah.
And he also needs to sit down and accept that I had an hour sat with him. On our patio here at home with him, and I went through everything with him. I said, look, you're going to realise that what you're doing now is to be able to sustain the changes you're making in your diet, things that you're not going to want to continue to do.
Right.
And I explained all of this to him. I said, but at the end of the day, we've got a limitation, and we've got a time limitation, which means we've got to do things to the extreme.
Right.
In order to get you there. And if you didn't, at the end of this, get what you hope to get out of it, we wouldn't be doing this.
Right. Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, cool.
Brilliant.
No problem.
I hope we find out who it is one day, but yeah. But like you said, a very extreme case. A very extreme case, Phil, yeah?
Because the outcome is something that is life-changing. It's value. Something that if he blows up after it, gets a bit fat, blah, 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 we can deal with that when we get to it.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, he needed to make a decision at that point that he was going to commit that was challenging to his body, challenging to his physique, challenging to everything. And that is the only time. I use that example a lot in seminars and things. There are times when these extreme approaches are required or have a place.
Yep.
But I'll tell you what, in my career, I've dealt with probably less than a dozen people.
Yep. I'm with you.
That have needed that kind of extreme approach. And at the end of it, typically they get a fucking great paycheck because of what they've done.
I'm with you. Yeah. Yeah. Phil, we have now spoken for an hour and 20 minutes, mate. I feel we could carry on speaking for hours.
I could talk forever.
I know, mate. I know that. And do you know what, mate? I'm sat here totally in the moment. I'm loving every minute of it. And I know that my lads are just going to get such great value from it. But I want to wrap things up there because I know you're a busy guy, you're a family man, and your daughter will probably be home from school now. And I've got a client in about 18 minutes that I need to get prepared for. But Phil, before we go, I want to, you know, ask you a little bit more about, just talk about yourself and what the plan is for the future for Phil Learney and the coaching academy, and where guys can find you, because I'm sure they're going to be fucking fired up after listening to this.
Where you'll find advancedcoachingacademy.com. Three courses within that that are certified and you know, get your CPDs, etc., etc. We run a business course, we run an applied nutrition course, we run an advanced coaching course. They run in synergy with each other. The whole premise behind all of that is just to improve the industry that I've grown to love. I've been in for many years. I want coaches out there to do it. My job for me,
yeah.
You know, and the best way for me to relay that is to educate them better, give them better tools to do their trade better, and in doing so, obviously, I'm developing a great business, you know, but again, it is all about the people. It's all about the people in it. The people are going to be affected by it. That's always going to be my driving factor. We want to turn the Advanced Coaches Academy to be the probably the most respected educational platform in the world for coaches. You know, we're starting to get some really big names writing articles and doing segments for us and writing about this, that, the other, and it. You know, we've got all angles covered, but it's a great platform. Everybody who's on it is loving it, and we're just going to grow that. I want to grow that. I want to continue to have the life that I've got.
Brilliant.
You know, there's no complaints about, you know, my life. I'm very happy. I've got everything I've ever dreamt of.
Fantastic. And you deserve it, mate. You deserve it with all this passion.
Well, thank you very much.
Excellent. Phil, honestly, mate, I cannot thank you enough. This has been recorded, it's been saved, and it's going straight off to my tech guy. No, honestly, for you to actually contact me and offer to do it again, mate, it really means a lot. So, guys, I've been chatting with Phil Learney. I'm sure you'll agree. This is he's the real deal, guys, and I really hope you get a lot of value from that 1 hour and 22 minutes of pure content. Guys, if you did like it, then please give us a share, leave us a comment on iTunes, and I'll be back next week. I'm going to try and rival this. I can't say we will, but I'll give it a bloody good go. So, Phil, thanks again, mate. Really appreciate your time. And guys, it's Coach Trek from 30 Plus Men's Fitness, and I'll talk to you all very soon. Keep trucking, guys.